Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks.
Welcome back to Homegrown. Bob Hill here.
And Janine Wishy.
And we're going to fly around a little bit today.
We are going to fly around.
And we're also grounded again.
Yeah. Literally and figuratively. Tom Turpin, our favorite entomologist,
with reason.
Out of Purdue. We haven't talked to him for a while, so it'll be good to talk to him.
Who's our second favorite entomologist then?
Another Purdue person, maybe.
Yeah.
We like Jody Ellis.
I know. I'm Hoosiers.
I'm telling you what. Okay. I love those Hoosiers. Okay. So Purdue wins the entomology favorite race. So Tom will be with us today to speculate about how our rainy, cool summer may have impacted insect activity and populations and that sort of thing. So
it's impacted me, and a lot of people have asked me, where are the butterflies? Mm-hmm. Where are the other bugs that we usually see
that
during the year?
Splatter across your windshield.
Even the hummingbirds, I haven't seen many of them. So something's going on, perhaps.
Perhaps, yeah. Exactly.
And,
yeah.
And Mr. Turpin will know.
Yeah, we'll talk to him in the first part of the show. And then we head out to Charlestown, Indiana to talk carnivorous plants.
Yeah, a man named Mike Galluli, who came by my place 2 or 3 years ago, and he was talking about raising carnivorous plants, pitcher plants, and Venus flytraps.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think it was possible in Indiana, and I went up and got some from him, and by golly, mine are growing this summer very well. Now we haven't tried the winter yet.
Yeah.
But he's overwintered his carnivorous plants for 2 or 3 years up there.
Okay.
So it can be done in the right place, in the right situation.
So maybe like a little micro-environment.
Yeah, he's right behind his house.
Scenario.
And he protects them in the winter. He mulches them a little bit, but they survive.
Yeah, well, we'll be heading up there and we'll see it for ourselves. So stick around. That's coming up today on Homegrown. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
2 1/4 new plants.
2 1/4 new plants? How'd you manage that?
Well, I'll explain here in a minute. I've always liked the word hop hornbeam.
Mm-hmm.
I've never grown one.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the hornbeam family, and I had a chance to get one last week, and I did, and I planted it. Looks like a hornbeam, basically a small kind of interesting gray bark tree with really kind of cool little nuts.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm raising it for those cool nuts. Besides, I can say, how's your hop hornbeam doing? And people have no reply to that.
They have no reply.
And then the Horstmann silverlock, the Korean fir. It's a gorgeous plant. It's got literally silver leaves and real interesting pine cones. It grows real slowly. It's just a stunning plant. I've killed two already.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to try it again.
Okay.
Third time. And finally, the viburnum.
And if you kill this one, will you give up?
Yes. Okay. No. No, I thought you were going to. I anticipated the wrong question.
So three is.
I will not give up.
Okay. So you'll just
keep
planting them.
I will not give up until I find one that works.
Okay.
Viburnum nudum. I think you've mm-hmm. got that too. The
sure.
winter tour. The berries in that thing are just incredible in the fall.
Yeah.
Pink and purple. Great leaf. Great flower.
It's got great fall color.
Yeah. It's a mm-hmm. wonderful plant. So, folks, go get a viburnum nudum and plant it, please.
Yes.
How about the Wishy Estate? What's up?
I have. The weather's just been perfect, really. I've been moving perennials around a lot.
I'm not surprised.
And, like, pretty much unfettered, you know.
Yeah.
That's crowded there, so let's move it here. That needs more stuff. Or, I mean, just everything is so healthy still.
Mm-hmm.
And the soil is moist, and it's easy to work, and it's just delightful work to do this time of the year.
Yeah, you mentioned redoing your perennial border to get a little more color.
Mm-hmm.
And different. Is that part of what you're doing?
It's mostly because stuff's getting crowded in areas. You know what I mean? And you've got to, you know, that's the balance of not overplanting.
Yeah.
But things fill out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So I've got like that one bed that I worked on in the old Japanese garden. That I think I overdid it last year, and it did so well. I've got to kind of thin some of the stuff out,
yeah.
But I've got places to put it.
Nothing
so.
Succeeds
it's
like
more
success.
More just crowded, yeah.
Now, do you chuck away your perennials if they're too crowded? Do you try and give them to friends, or what do you do with them? Depends who's
a
handy.
A little bit of everything.
Yeah, if someone's around, I'll
frankly,
give them to them.
Yeah.
If they're not, they go into compost.
Yeah, and I'm not afraid. I got over that a long time ago.
Right.
You just create a monster for yourself if you think you've got to replant everything somewhere else.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And then you have just more of the same spread out instead of, you know, for people like us, we want diversity and something different and room for new things. So you've got to show some reasonable ability to chuck something in the compost pile.
The guts to do it.
Yep. So that's what's going on. So yeah, if there's stuff you need to plant or to dig and divide, Go at
it. Including shrubs and small trees.
Sure, absolutely.
And speaking of colors in the garden, there's something going on at Bernheim, I think.
There is. Bernheim's Color Fest is, in fact, this weekend, yesterday, October 17th, and today, Sunday the 18th. So you want to head out there if you missed it yesterday and check out Color Fest. Totally family-friendly events, all kinds of activities going on. And, of course, who can beat Bernheim in late October?
You can't.
Exactly, the Color Fest.
Questions. We get questions. We get questions every day. Miss Wishy?
Yep.
This is really a nice question. It's got a motherly, maternal tones to it.
Cool.
Yet intellectually interesting.
And about spiders to boot.
Just like our show.
Okay.
It's Mary Beth O'Reilly. Mm-hmm. She says, we had the pleasure of hosting a very large garden spider for about 8 weeks this fall. From what I found online, I believe she was the Argiope aurantia, or the zipper spider, mm-hmm. black with yellow spots, and the designer of a large orb-shaped web, which included a zip-zap pattern. Of course, that's a zipper spider. During her time with us, she created two large egg sacs. Last week, on the coldest night thus far, her entire web disappeared, leaving only the two egg sacs attached to our fence post. She says she's amazed how much she enjoys having the spider
Good.
Around, which is kind of neat. Yeah,
it is.
And she looked it up some more, and she said each egg sac contains anywhere from 800 to 1,400 babies. Alas, the mom has disappeared in the cold snap.
Uh-huh.
Should she relocate the sacs to the park, or should she keep them by her house, and she fears being overrun by these zip-zag spiders?
Leave them where they are.
Yeah.
Leave them where they are. And you're not going to be overrun by spiders because basically, I mean, think about it. When those spiders hatch out, they're actually teeny tiny.
Yeah.
And most of them are going to, you know, be eaten by a bird or somebody else. You are not going to be overrun by zipper spiders. You know, in fact, those egg masses may not even last through the winter because something can get it even before they hatch out. So, you know, just let nature run its course. She had also mentioned that it was in a shrub. She was worried if she had too many spiders in the shrub.
Right.
Actually, your spiders are going to be advantageous because they're going to eat potentially other pests that could, you know, get into your plants. So just enjoy them while they're around and leave them alone, the eggs and such, while they're not, and let nature run its course.
But nature can be a cold and tough teacher.
Mm-hmm.
If all the spider eggs survive from every spider,
we would be in big trouble.
Or every other creature out there, as far as that goes.
Yeah.
So the winnowing out process is pretty
strong. That's right. I sort of like have visions of some of those horror movies of spiders taking over the world. If all the spider eggs did actually survive, we probably would be in a little bit of trouble.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Call us at 814-8246. And we'll be right back after this break when we'll talk to Purdue entomologist Tom Turpin about bugs. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
And Bob Hill.
Tom Turpin is joining us now. Tom's been teaching entomology at Purdue University for over 30 years, where he has developed a really good reputation, don't you think, Bob?
Yes.
That, quite frankly, has style when it comes to insects and our relationship to them. So we thought it'd be a good idea to talk to Tom because we were wondering what that relationship was like this past season. Because we've gotten so many questions from our listeners about windshields, about woolly worms, about butterfly populations. So, Tom, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
Great. All in all, it's been a cool, rainy season. So the question is, how can excessive spring rains and then, you know, milder temperatures impact insect populations? Do we know?
Well, we don't really know. And the thing that, when we get a question like that, I try to always address it in this way, is that insects include a lot of different creatures, and, mm-hmm. and they all do not respond to different conditions in the same way. So technically, we almost have to ask a question about a specific insect and not insects in general, although we can speculate about insects in general.
Okay. So in general, then,
let's speculate.
No, and I do have specific questions about specific creatures, you know, insects and bugs and such. in general, then, speculatively, does a cool start delay insect development in the spring of the year?
Well, we don't even have to speculate about that. The answer to that is yes.
Okay.
When we have a cool spring and insects are cold-blooded organisms, and so as temperatures tend to be low, then the development of insects does slow way down. So when we have a cool, wet spring, not only does the coolness slow them down, but a lot of insects are just getting going in the springtime by laying eggs, and those eggs, especially if that wet is associated with rain, many times can be washed off of plants, and that can have an impact on them as well.
Okay.
Well, Tom, generally speaking, do you keep specific track of any insects at all? Does anybody count mosquitoes or butterflies or wasps?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, because if you're a researcher working on a specific mosquito, for example, you very well may keep track of that. Years ago, when I was active in corn rootworm research, we had a monitoring system, and we could tell you specifically whether or not the corn rootworm beetle populations were up or down. Mm-hmm. But in general, people probably do not keep records of insects across a wide range of species. Now, we do a butterfly count here in July each year, and we can kind of get an indication comparatively from year to year whether or not the populations are up or down. But again, that's on a certain date, and sometimes the population might just be delayed and ultimately might be as high as in the previous year, just not on that day.
Right. So okay, what was the butterfly count like this year, do you know?
Well, it turns out that, again, it was up and down some. Mm-hmm. We had some species that were down from a year ago, but then we had a few species where the populations on the count were actually up. Mm-hmm. Monarch butterflies, for example, were actually down a little bit this year compared to the year before, and whether or not that means that monarch numbers in this area were down significantly, we don't know. Mm-hmm. But certainly the numbers we counted were down a bit.
Mm-hmm. So I know that monarchs weren't here in January with our ice storm, but they were probably still around last September when we had all that wind. So when we look back at sort of the accumulative effect of various weather conditions, you know, wind in September 14th last year, could that have just totally decimated some of our local butterfly populations, because it was 80 mile an hour winds for 8 hours sort of thing?
Exactly. Butterflies are not very aerodynamic, and when we get those heavy winds, it does take a toll on butterflies. Now, whether or not the monarch population that we would have seen this year might have been impacted by the winds, let's say, in the Louisville area, probably not, because there's so many of the monarchs that are migrating in a localized kind of a situation, probably not going to have a big impact on it as would, let's say, an unusual winter in their overwintering area.
Okay.
Tom, it just seemed to me that I saw less insects this year. How about the Tom Turpin seat of the pants count in your backyard? Do you think this year there was less somehow?
I don't think I would say that up here. What we did certainly see this year was that there was a delay throughout the season. And so at any particular time when you were out looking, if you said, well, last year I remember seeing an awful lot of bees on honeybees or bumblebees on those flowers. This year at this time I didn't see quite as many. That may reflect the fact that their populations were developing more slowly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we need to think about exactly what the times might be.
So wait 2 weeks before you before you make your official assessment of the insect population.
And exactly, and I think the question about what did I see this year, okay, if you were out on a day this year and the temperatures are cooler, you are going to see less insects because they are associated, again, with the temperature. When temperatures are low, they're just not as active. They're not flitting around as much. Mm-hmm. So even though there might be as many of them out there, they're probably hiding under a leaf somewhere or maybe even out sunbathing somewhere rather than flying around.
Well, in fact, I have noticed that because we were over at a friend's house for dinner, and she had these beautiful zinnias in a pot, and we laughed because it was basically like this drunken bee that had its face smashed into the middle of the flower, but, you know, wasn't moving except maybe twitching a little bit, but it was a cool evening,
right.
And at that point, they just can't I mean, don't they have to have a body temperature of something to be able to actually fly about?
Well, in a general rule, insects are active at above 50 degrees Fahrenheit,
okay.
Although bees can actually increase that a little bit by muscular
mm-hmm.
contraction, and so they get their body temperature up a bit. But what happens is that a bee gets out in a flower like that, temperatures drop down, and all of a sudden they're below the flight threshold, so they're sort of stuck at that flower overnight until the sun comes out.
Well, at least he had his face in pollen.
Exactly.
Homeland Security put up with that.
That's funny. Okay, let's talk about Japanese beetle populations. If it's really rainy in the spring, you had talked about how other types of insect eggs can be washed away off of a leaf, for example. What about the grubs of these beetles? You know, Japanese beetles, Max Schaeffers, they're in the lawn in the grub state. If it's really wet and soggy, is that going to kill off, you know, some of the population?
Well, that's kind of wishful thinking,
sure.
Really. We get a wet spring. Actually, the truth is that we may, in fact, decrease the populations, not because they drown. They're pretty adapted to standing in the soggy soil. But wet conditions sometimes increase the number of disease organisms that attack them, and so we may in fact lose some of them in a fairly moist
natural
and wet spring because of disease, not because they drown, but certainly all that water is not beneficial to them. They would prefer not to be an aquatic insect.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Tom, are Japanese beetles somewhat territorial anyway? I had really bad problems 5-6 years ago, not so much now, and others tell me they still have them.
You know, the same thing has happened up here. At our place this year, the Japanese beetle populations were probably as low as I've seen in several years.
Mm-hmm.
I was tempted to say it's a low Japanese beetle year, and then one of my neighbors said, I've never had so many Japanese beetles as I had in my life. And so you're right. What we get are general fluctuations across an area, and some years the whole area will be bad. And then some years the whole area may be down some, but there will be isolated spots, for whatever reason,
mm-hmm.
where they may be much higher right in that area than they had been for 2 or 3 years. So,
mm-hmm.
But I think generally this year Japanese beetle populations were down. If our number of callers, number of people that let us know that they're having problems is any indication, we certainly received a lot less complaints this year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're a little worried here about the emerald ash borer, too. Has that been affected this year much by the winds or the weather, as far as you know?
Well, the emerald ash borer is primarily dependent on humans to transport it any great distance. It does not, what we call towering, which would be to fly up and get caught in the winds. It will move fairly short distances on its own, but typically that's going to be along rivers, where we might have the ash trees from ash tree to ash tree.
Mm-hmm.
When we get these big leaps into areas, it's normally courtesy of humans bringing some firewood with them.
Okay. The weather front thing, I was reading that dragonflies, those sorts of like damselflies, they'll get caught up in weather fronts, like a cool front.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have a whole bunch of dragonflies, and then one day the front moves through, and then it takes them away again to some other spot. Is that, in fact, what happens?
It is what happens. The dragonflies will tower as well. And I remember some years ago, I happened to be going home, and I just got in the middle of one of these great dragonfly migrations, not necessarily being carried by the wind.
Mm-hmm.
But I went around it. It was nearly a half a mile wide and almost a mile long.
So what did you see?
Dragonflies just about as thick as you could see,
wow.
just zooming around, all moved in a southwest direction.
So is that what happens when, like, frogs start raining from the sky? You know, that weird thing that people talk about?
Well, I've never seen frogs raining from the sky, so I'll have to take your word for that one.
But haven't you heard that?
Happens in Simpsonville all the time, Tom.
Or, I think it happens in Texas or something, but, like, they get sucked up
maybe
in
tadpoles.
A tornado or something, and then they rain down somewhere else.
All right. I'll take this under advisement. You know, we've heard it raining cats and dogs, but I've never heard it raining frogs.
I've heard that before.
But certainly insects do rain down, and you can, in fact, do research. Planes carrying traps and things up in these great swarms will find that are a number of insects that are being carried by the winds. Entomologists call it the plankton of the air.
Ah. Wow. So that could account for lots of them one day and then everybody being gone the next.
It could, but more likely what we would see would be that we don't see many of anything, and then the
and
next
then
day there are quite a few of them here.
Okay.
Well, this
wow.
brings up a question a little off the point, but still interesting. The great plagues of locusts back in the Depression days, where did they come from and what happened to them?
That's a good question. Actually, they originated in the mountain areas to the west, in the Rocky Mountains. Some people think that the great herds of buffalo actually created an environment that was conducive to their populations building up to the migratory form. And as the buffalo were decimated, we started farming some of the areas that were their breeding sites. They, in fact, appear to be extinct now, what we used to call the Rocky Mountain locust. But in Africa, there are still those migratory locusts of a different species. Mm-hmm. Only the Rocky Mountain locust appears to have disappeared.
So was the Rocky Mountain locust actually locust? Because I didn't think we had any of those in North America.
Well, what are locusts are the migratory grasshoppers.
Oh,
and the Rocky
okay.
Mountain locust was a migratory grasshopper.
Okay.
We use the term locust in this part of the world for cicadas, which is an incorrect
sure.
name for them. Our early settlers on the East Coast saw the great masses of cicadas, and they were only used to great masses of grasshoppers, mm-hmm. so they called them locusts.
Hmm. It's pretty biblical.
It is pretty
very
biblical.
Yeah. And certainly, if you read Little House on the Prairie, you know how devastating they were in those days.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, I've noticed that I've maybe created a little bit better of a habitat for a certain insect because I've noticed more of them. And Tom, we have certain areas that we don't mow on the farm. So I've created this environment, perhaps, that what I've identified as a type of stink bug, like the leaf-footed stink bug.
The leaf-footed one, yes.
Yeah. So since I've got these areas of tall grass around, is that why I've got more leaf-footed stink bugs on my windows and about the house?
I couldn't say that for sure, but let me put it this way. A mowed lawn is not a good place for insects.
Yeah.
And as we let it go back to a taller, mm-hmm. a more sturdy type of a habitat, we tend to then do have a wider range of insects that will survive successfully there. Mm-hmm. And the leaf-footed bug, which very well may be one of those, mm-hmm. may have benefited from your lack of lawn mowing.
Mm-hmm. Bob and I were talking about the lightning bug populations.
Yeah.
The fact that we do mow so much grass, is that impacting insect populations, you know, desirable and undesirable, I suppose, but impacting that balance to where if you just let everybody be happy out there, wouldn't they kind of take care of each other?
To a certain extent, but there are insect populations that, even though they have predators and parasites and things that feed on them, mm-hmm. those populations still periodically will explode, like the migratory locust, for
okay.
example. And that certainly was one that was under natural control, but there were great flocks of those, you know, ever so often mm-hmm. In the West, even before there were at least the European settlers here to interfere with them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know when I was a kid, and I moved to a place in the country.
Now we're talking ancient history.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah. This times are really going
to
change.
Me and the Romans, how much time have we got to talk about
yeah.
it? Back in the 1800s, when I was a kid, I know we used to go out and catch lightning bugs in bottles by the billions. And when I moved to my 30 acres of ground in Indiana about 30 years ago, there was all kinds of lightning bugs, and I swear there are less now.
Well, there probably are, for a lot of reasons. One is we have kind of eliminated their breeding sites. They like swampy-type areas for breeding. We certainly have polluted their environment with light, and we call them lightning bugs because they use that light to attract a mate. And if you have a pole light out there, they are not going to be very effective in being able to use their light for that purpose.
Ah. Okay, that makes sense.
So all of that stuff, if you look at an aerial a satellite photograph of these areas and see the lights that are there, that's not good firefly habitat. Hmm. Back in the day you're talking about, yeah. Bob, there probably were a lot less lights around. Certainly we didn't use the pole lights and things like
we
do today, even at our place.
Sure.
We have a pole light we can turn on, and the fireflies try to avoid it and get behind the barn where it's dark.
Man, I've gone from perplexed to guilty here now.
Yeah.
Oh, exactly.
That's exactly why I turned off all of our landscape lighting. because it just seemed stupid.
Yeah, we've done the same thing. We don't leave just the pole light on, but I did notice when it would be on, if I went out to watch the fireflies and to see how many species we might have, in the glow of the pole light, there wasn't anybody. But you got behind the barn where the pole light shaded it, there they all were.
You see the stars that way, too.
That's right. Tom, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I've enjoyed chatting with you.
All right. Tom Turpin is an entomologist at Purdue University, where he has a reputation for talking about the amazing things bugs and insects can do. Tom's been teaching entomology at Purdue for over 30 years, and he's the founder of the infamous Bug Bowl and writes the bi-monthly column On Six Legs. And, of course, for more information on him or anything on the show today, you can see our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we head to Charlestown, Indiana, for some information on how to grow insect-eating plants. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And we are sitting on a lovely deck in the wilds of Stacy Road in southern Indiana.
In southern Indiana, a place we love.
Yeah, just a little bit south of Charlestown. Peering over the top of the deck to our left, it's a bog garden where we're looking at Venus flytraps, pitcher plants, sundews, and many others. Perfectly hardy here in Clark County.
Well, and in fact, native to here. I was surprised. We're here with Mike Galluli showing us the plants, Mike. You know, many of the ones that you have outside are native to North America all the way up to Canada. So it's not unheard of to have these plants in your backyard.
No, it's not. Most in this bog garden is from Southeast United States, which are the trumpet pitchers. Mm-hmm. And then you have some that move well up into Canada, which is Purpurea, Sarracenia purpurea, which is a more lower growing pitcher plant, and as well as the sundews.
Okay, so those would be the three major species that people might want to try and that are hardy in our area.
Well, of course, the Venus flytrap is the most popular that everybody is at least heard of. Very easy to grow once you give it what it needs. Very easy.
Okay, well, we'll get into those details first, but I know Bob's always likes to know how on earth you got involved in all this.
Mike, how on earth did you get involved in all this?
Well, when I was about 8, 9 years old, my next door neighbor had purchased a plant for their son. He showed me this Venus flytrap, and I just thought it was the coolest thing in the world. Very intriguing, to say the least. And a few years later, I was in 7th grade in a science class, and the teacher had shown us some film, and the film actually showed us some Venus flytrap and sundews. And then I was hooked for sure then.
As a 7th grader.
Well, and I had a friend then that was also very intrigued, and so something in common to keep one another kind of going. But the science fair that year, that's what I did my science fair on, was Venus flytraps.
So, no looking back since then, one of the things that you had mentioned to us earlier is that if you know what they need and you can give it to them, then they're actually really easy to grow. So tell us about, I guess, you know, from the ground up, how you built this bog garden so that all of these carnivorous plants would thrive.
Okay. You're basically going to use dig out and use a pond liner. Mm-hmm. And you're going to use about a 50-50 mixture of sphagnum peat and sand. Just make sure it's either play sand or horticultural sand, that it's sterile and clean. Potting soil would be lethal. The water needs to be the rainwater, distilled water, sodium-free distilled water, and or reverse osmosis. So, I collect rainwater.
Okay, so you say potting soil would be lethal. Why is it so important to use the sphagnum peat moss and the sand and natural rainwater?
Because the potting soil is it's too many minerals, fertilizers and whatnot that's in the potting soil. The sphagnum peat is very low in minerals, very highly acidic, probably around 5, probably something like that, but it could be lower. Mm-hmm. And sphagnum peat derives from the live sphagnum on top of the soil. So as it breaks down, it turns into sphagnum peat, and so it's low in mineral, and in essence, that's where the by using and catching insects, that's where the plants
are getting the nutrients.
Yes,
okay,
that's where they get
the soil so
yes.
much.
Let's talk about the process of the plant dissolving an insect. How does that work? What's in there that makes them so tasty to the plants?
Most of all carnivorous plants produce their own enzymes. And some, the Nepenthes, from my understanding, is probably the strongest enzymes. And it's very acid. It might get as low as 2, which is very acidic. And there's going to be some bacteria that if rainwater, the air, whatnot, is going to, the rain is going to enter in to a lot of these pitchers. So then as the insects break down, the leaves, these are modified leaves on these plants, and then they're able to reabsorb the nutrients, and so therefore that's where they back into their...
I had thought that those were the flowers, but as you just explained, they're modified leaves, so that's where that absorption takes place. Typically, we think of flowers as like the sexual organ and maybe attracting insects. So how does this modified leaf attract the insect to begin with so it can eventually start to consume it and get energy from it?
Well, a couple of different ways. One is by color, a lot of vibrant colors, a lot of reds, but they most all produce a nectar. And of course, a smell, whatnot, so that's going to attract.
Are they usually stinky smells? Because flies and other types of insects might be more inclined to come to stinky than fragrant, not necessarily.
Well, I've gotten my nose pretty close to a lot of these plants, and unless it's the insect matter it's bad, but
right.
No.
Okay.
There is one plant, and that's the Sarracenia rubra, and they actually, the nickname for that is sweet trumpet plant, so, and it actually smells like cherry Kool-Aid, so very pleasant smelling.
Mike, you mentioned earlier the colors, and I was amazed at that. I got pitcher plants from you that are yellow and red, and even now, as you look out your back deck here, there's some white pitcher plants. They're just gorgeous here in early, mid-October. So how many different colors are available in these plants?
Well, the white one you're talking about is Sarracenia leucophylla, which is nicknamed the white trumpet plant. The flowers on that are red. Most of the trumpets, I mean, some can be yellow. The flava is yellow flower. Some of them might be more of a pale or ivory in color. But a lot of the pitchers, some are just green, but some of them are veined with a lot of reds. And some, like the purpurea in minor, and then there's some hybrids that the whole leaf is a deep maroon or almost burgundy color. So very pretty plants.
Let's describe the pitcher plant a little bit more, because I was so fascinated to look inside. I mean, literally the name pitcher plant comes from the fact that it fills up with water just from the rain. Some of them are hooded, so it probably acts, you know, doesn't fill up with as much water. You look inside and it's full of a bunch of writhing insects.
Dead bugs.
Well, and like still just sort of, you know, moving about. So they're extremely effective. But the white ones, Mike, I was interested in because they're kind of hooded. And like I looked inside and they're insects and there's, you know, there's not any liquid or there doesn't seem to be anything that's sort of holding them back. So what actually keeps them in their death sentence, their death grip, without them flying out and flying free?
These modified leaves are just, and that's what's so intriguing. They have a waxy, usually say the trumpet pitchers, the hooded pitcher plants, and that could be flava, leucophylla, there's rubra and aurophylla. They have downward pointing hair. So up around the rim of it is maybe a waxy foothold, and these downward pointing hairs on the hood want to funnel the insects to the mouth of the plant. And the nectar is around that lip. And so, and as they get going down that downward pointing hairs, they lose their grip.
So once they're in there because it smells good, looks good, then bam, those hairs sort of keep you down.
Yes, well, you know, and one theory as far as on the flying insects, why can't they just fly back out? Well, one is they don't have enough room. The trumpet pitchers go from an inch or two or whatever diameter down to nothing. There's different digestive zones. There's different zones, and not to get into all that. But The other theory is that they create a vacuum and they have no lift with their wings to get out. So there's a couple theories on flying insects. And then as the trap fills up, the digestive fluids, because of the insects moving and struggling,
really
they flow in just like a Venus flytrap. When it's sealed, it'll flow in these digestive enzymes that will essentially drown the insect and then go to work on it.
Wow.
And Mike, I didn't realize the Venus flytrap is native only to one small area in the United States, and that area is shrinking. So talk about that a little bit.
Well, the habitat destruction, because of urbanization, sprawl, just building. The area that the Venus flytrap is a 100-mile radius of Wilmington, North Carolina, which is in the very southeast part of North Carolina, used to cover about 3 counties of the northern part of South Carolina. Now I've read that's down to about 1 county. And there was 30-something counties in North Carolina, and that's dropped quite a few. People don't understand that these bogs that are disappearing are very good for watershed. They hold many times their weight in water, sphagnum peat, many times their weight. One theory is that flooding will be more of a problem because now you have more streets, and streets and concrete, et cetera, do not absorb water. It's going to run off, and it's going to run off fast.
And then hardiness. You talked about some of these plants are naturally hardy and some aren't. So how do you protect your plants in the winter?
I just use, 4 or 5 inches of pine needles. I mean, as the winter goes on, I might just start with a couple inches. But as it goes on, I might have to add some more if we get into some really cold. But I normally just start off just like you normally would when you're mulching something to keep the freezing and thawing lifting. I have found in the springtime when I uncovered that some of the plants have been fly traps and whatnot, even though they was lifted pretty much out of ground, they all lived. It was no problem at all. I mean, so some, the purpurea, the drosera, the sundew, round leaf, they can stand no problem, but they're in there, so they get covered too.
Mm-hmm. So Mike, are there any carnivorous plant communities? Do you have friends online? Do you have friends, local friends that you can swap plants with? Are there good resources if people are truly interested in, starting to get some of these plants? What are our options in terms of connecting with more people like you?
Well, the International Carnivorous Plant Society would be a good place to start, and they do have a seed swap, and that's really the best place to start.
Because where do you usually buy your plants?
A lot online. Uh-huh. You can find them, but be very cautious in local nurseries and whatnot, just to make sure that they haven't been
abused,
captured from the wild, dug up, and being resold and whatnot. Be aware of that. I haven't seen any around here that I'm aware of, but a lot online. California Carnivores out in North California is a huge.
Great name.
One of the largest, and carnivorous plant nursery in Jersey. And so there's many, many carnivorous plant stores out there.
Mike, thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot. Thanks
a lot
for coming,
Mike.
Out.
Very, very interesting.
Thanks for having me.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it really was. Mike Galluli raises carnivorous plants off Stacy Road in southern Indiana. For more information on Mike, carnivorous plants, or to see photos of his garden, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
That ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, we've got some garden witchery and black plants.
Homegrown is produced by the insect-averting Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.